is 8:00 a.m. We have a quorum of the Audit Committee, thanks to Stacy here. I now call this meeting of the Audit Committee of the Finance Commission of Texas to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes of the Finance Commission Audit Committee meeting held December 15th, 2017. These minutes were circulated to the members in the agenda pack. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes of the Finance Commission Audit Committee meeting held on December 15th, 2017?
So moved.
Second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Okay, next, we have the review of the agency's activities. Who do we have first? Caroline?
Yes, for savings and mortgage lending on page 5, we are in process of working on the recommendation regarding establishing audit trails.
Okay.
And then the Office of the Consumer Credit Commissioners report is next on page 6. And this is an item we've been reporting to you from Garza Gonzalez and Associates audit on our motor vehicle sales finance area. And this was a finding related to our review of the report of examination. And there are a number of controls and issues we were working on to address this finding, and so those have now all been completed. So I'm happy to answer any more questions about, but it's all been completed. And then the other item I wanted to mention, as I reported at the last meeting, about the post-payment audit by the Comptroller's Office, we still have no report on that post-payment audit of payroll and expenditures that they completed the field work, performed the field work in October. So maybe in the next couple of months, we'll get something, but still nothing.
Hey, Caroline, I have one question before we, and I apologize. So can you give me like a percentage of how far along in the progress you are on that?
I'm going to ask Stephen O'Shields to come.
Okay.
Talk about that, because that's, he's handling that.
All right.
Stephen O'Shields, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Actually, I've got a meeting scheduled next week to work further. We're looking at the third-party, our third-party vendor that is, does our network information, has been looking at different softwares to potentially purchase to do this function. And so they've got some that they've got narrowed down. And so hopefully by the next meeting, this will be resolved.
Okay, perfect. All right, thank you. Cheryl?
Okay, for the Department of Banking on the outstanding audit findings, the answer or question is nine. However, we have submitted the documents for our Texas Workforce Commission to the Texas Workforce Commission for the audit of hiring, promotion, and appraisals. I think we believe that that might be available in the May timeframe. And we have not received yet the final report from the Comptroller on our post-payment audit. So that's been a while. Other than that, we have nothing.
Okay.
But I will say, whoever said that we never, these agencies never get audited. We have audits all the time.
I don't remember anybody saying that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we've heard that.
As a bank, we're not feeling sorry for you.
Yeah.
I wasn't asking for something.
Okay, do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the agency's November 30th, 2017 investment officer report?
So moved.
Oh, am I? I went ahead, I'm sorry. All right. Okay, so let's go through the investment reports, starting with Caroline.
Yes, on page 9 is the recovery fund report. It tells you what CDs are out there and where those funds are invested. Also, do want to mention on page 10 that so far in fiscal year 18, we've had one recovery fund payment of $2,000. And
is that it?
That's it, unless anyone has questions.
I've got a question. So you have a couple that expired December 17th.
This chart is as of November 30th.
Correct. So in that renewal, did you go back into 2 years, and do you know at what rate?
Antonia, do you know that?
Because I know the rate's rising.
Right, right.
Antonia, Antof Savings and Mortgage Lending, could you please repeat your question?
So, you've got a couple CDs that have matured recently. I want to know what the term and the interest rate you received on them.
The ones that we renewed in December, I will double check, but I'm pretty sure they remain the same.
At that rate, in that 24 months? Okay, so it seems like we're, I mean, they're doing 2% now on shorter terms, and it seems like it's going to continue to rise, so I would think as renewals come up, we should be shopping or asking for more.
Go shorter term, too.
Go shorter term, okay.
Yeah, because it's just most likely going to rise, I believe. You guys will know that better than I do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioners, the first report's on page 11, and this is the Residential Mortgage Loan Originator Recovery Trust Fund. Really pretty standard activity, some additions to the fund which came through new contributions from the first quarter. But so that's really standard for that small fund. On page 12 is the larger fund for the Texas Financial Education Endowment, and you'll see a number of items here. In the upper portion of the report, you'll see the addition of the funds that you approved from the prior quarter that came from the contribution from SML, and then you'll see the transfer of funds into the investment portfolio, $700,000 transfer in the investment portfolio. If you look at the investment portfolio overall for the first quarter, notwithstanding, irrespective of the transfer, the fund was up 2.7% in that first fiscal quarter. And then overall, you see there's $3.7 million in the investment portfolio, and the overall fund is at $4.651 million. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And we'll have a presentation a little bit later on the agenda today from the Texas Treasury Safekeeping Trust, and they'll give you some detailed background about the fund allocations and some more information so they can answer a lot of questions for the commission. And they do this for us about every other year.
Okay. All right. Next. On page 13, we have the trust-funded prepaid funeral guarantee fund investment report. Starting out at on the left side, $1,345,000. We have the deductions, and they are footnoted there. And then we have the additions, and they are also footnoted. Nothing abnormal or unusual in these activities. So any questions on those expenditures or additions? So Victor? Then on page 14, we have the insurance-funded guarantee fund, and interest and the trustee fee are only activities on there. Then on page 15, we have the C's funds, which we do not have any at this time. And I would like to tell you all that all of these three funds will be audited by Garza. It's in their plan, and they'll be doing that probably the 1st of March.
Okay. And so I would say, Vince, probably the same comment regarding the maturities there, right?
Yes, Stephanie.
Stephanie Newberg, Texas Department of Banking. I just wanted to add that when ours matured in December, we went out and looked at multiple banks. We didn't get offered 2% anywhere. There are better rates than what we had in here, but we didn't get 2% on anything. And we looked at 6 months and a year. So they're better, but they're not at the 2% that asking.
Let me clarify. The 2% was just like this week I got offered. Mm-hmm. 1.60 has been since December, January.
Right, and the other thing, our problem is most banks don't want us because we don't have accounts there and we're not in the community. I mean, we have banks that tell us no, that they don't want our certificates of deposit. And there's lots of paperwork that we have to go through. When we do put it at a bank CD, all of our personal information has to be given to the bank because we're the signers on the account. So moving them a lot is very difficult as well, just because of all the personal information from several members of the agency that they have to get and resolutions they have to get that the bank has to have.
We're a risky investment.
Yeah, but the higher rates, they normally tell us no.
And well, in addition to that, would you also comment, because I'm assuming it's the same for all the agencies that you deal with, the banks that you regulate, so that you know that they're fiscally sound and such, so if you
right.
would comment on
we,
that.
We only go to state banks, and our banking side gives us a listing of the portfolios of the banks that have the highest CD rates in their portfolios, and that's the ones we go to try to get the best rate possible.
Well, in Dallas-Fort Worth area, I know several state banks that give higher rates.
Okay.
And Stephanie, what would be the current rate that Treasury Safekeeping is given? Probably hear that later.
I think it's about right at 1%. We actually have seriously considered putting it all back in the Treasury because it's not that much difference in the grand scheme of what you earn, and it's so much easier than all the individualized CDs. So if it continues to rise, that you'll probably see more of it going back into the Treasury Safekeeping.
Okay, that's all we have.
All right. Now, do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the agency's November 30th, 2017 investment officer reports?
So moved.
Stacy, second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
The ayes have it and the motion passes. Next, we have a discussion of and possible vote to recommend that the Finance Commission take action on the agency's 2018 first quarter financial statements.
Antonio will present.
All righty.
For SML.
Our first quarter statement is on page 17. At this point, there's not much to say. It's still early in the year. Our revenues are 11.5% over budget, mostly due to the penalties collected. Our licensing revenues are right on track. And our expenditures are 5% under budget, mostly due to vacancies. But we will see that gap closing in the second quarter and in the third quarter even more. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Yes, sir.
A couple of numbers jumped off the page
sure.
to me, and under revenue, one mm-hmm. of them was fines and penalties, $220,000.
Right.
And it was zero before, or was
it's budgeted at zero. We don't budget for the penalties, because this is not something that we want to our budget to be built on the amount that we collect.
Mm-hmm.
So we always budget zero. But last year, for the whole year, we collected almost $800,000. So we've had years with over $1 million
mm-hmm.
in penalties.
Okay.
So it fluctuates widely. It's very difficult to predict because we don't know what it's going to be until an exam is complete. So
then, under expenditures, what is classified? $50,738.
The classified salaries are all the employees. The exempt is only the commissioner that has exempt salary, and this is just based on the...
So classified just means all
classified
others?
Classified is everybody else. That's part of the classification by the state auditor's office.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Our changes to the balance statement is on page 19. At this point, we're at 12.5 months of reserves, which is the exact same we were last year at this time. We're going to see it growing a little bit more in the second quarter and then starting to go down in the third and the fourth quarter. And the charts that make it easy to see is on page 20.
Okay.
Any questions?
Okay. The Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner report is on page 21 for the first quarter financial statement. And I'll just make a couple of highlights on that and be happy to entertain any questions. The revenues are presently reported at 114% of our budget. It's, November's an interesting month because it sort of overlaps our renewal cycles. So we've got four that close in December. So we've got four different types of activities that are currently renewing. And sometimes people choose to renew in November rather than December, so it's kind of a difficult to forecast month, so we'll see that. But most of the adjustments are due to that kind of timing. There are some late fees and penalties which are reflected there. Most of those are really late fees, but those factor into discounts for upcoming, off of upcoming assessments. So we will factor those in for upcoming renewal cycles. Expenditures are running about 93% of budget, and personnel costs are about 94%. There's a little bit of turnover in that number and a commensurate reduction also in travel expenditures. But again, it's fairly early in the cycle, and first quarter often does run a little bit lean. So the changes in cash balance are on page 23, and we're at about 6.7 months, and again, we're kind of at a little bit of a peak cycle, and we'll also be at a little bit of peak after renewals conclude in the second quarter, but then that kind of begins to decline. So we'll watch that.
Okay, Jamie.
Good morning, Sandy Chadwick, Texas Department of Banking. On page 24 is our operating statement for the first quarter. Our revenues are at 101.2% of budget, and our expenditures are at 97.1% of budget, so pretty on the line there. On page 25 is our explanation of variances for the first quarter. I'm going to go over four items. The first one is in-state travel. We had a positive variance there because of four things. First, we had a lower department conference expenditures than budgeted. Second, we had a scheduled on-site loan review that was performed off-site. We had various meetings that were not attended. And finally, we just have overall efficient use of staff and resources. Under professional fees and services, we had a positive variance too. That is because we didn't have any architect fees incurred, and we had lower expenditures than budgeted for attorney general fees, building-related outside counsel fees, and administrative law judge fees. Then the last two items are consumable supplies and other operating. Under consumable supplies, we had a positive variance because we had some IT purchases that were incorrectly budgeted under consumables but were charged operating expenses, and we apologize for that. Those expenditures were for software maintenance and a camera that was a controlled item. And finally, under other operating, we had a negative variance because of the IT purchases that were initially under the consumable supplies. And then we had higher than anticipated shared receptionist expenditures and higher than budgeted deferred maintenance expenditures for this quarter. Are there any questions so far? And then on page 26 is our cash flow statement. We are at 3.61 months for this quarter. Last year we were at 3.58 for the same quarter.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2018 first quarter financial statements?
So moved.
Okay. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the ayes have it and the motion passes. Okay, next, we have a presentation from the Texas Treasury Safekeeping Company, and we have Paul Ballard here, who is the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer, that will take us through the presentation.
Copies here. Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it two different ones?
No, it's just one.
Thank you. Thanks.
Sure. I just brought a lot of them. So.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members. My name is Paul Ballard. I'm the CEO and the Chief Investment Officer of the Texas Treasury Safekeeping Trust Company. So what I was prepared to talk about this morning, I hope this is what you're looking for, is to tell you a little bit about the Texas Treasury Safekeeping Trust Company, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, and also then to review the endowment fund that we are managing for you all. So if that works,
perfect.
Tee off. Behind tab one, there's a long narrative. Just to give you an idea, I certainly won't walk through it page by page, but give you a narrative of who the trust company is. We're a little bit of an unusual entity within state government. We are actually a corporation, but we are a wholly owned subsidiary of the state controller's office. So the trust company has a corporate charter, but we're held within state government. So the controller, Glenn Hager, is our chairman and our sole shareholder. So we belong to the state, and our mission is to invest state resources. We have a fairly sizable investment management team. We manage a number of different strategies for the state. We have a little unusual, one of, I think, two states that has Federal Reserve membership, or not membership, we have a Federal Reserve account. We're not a member of the Federal Reserve. That was granted back in the 80s. So we have access to the Fed wire system, and we have a DTC account. That allows us to self-custody the investments in the treasury pool. The state treasury pool is a short-term, kind of a cash equivalence pool. Think of it as a money market fund on steroids. So we manage it like a money market fund, but our duration is a little bit longer, so we can manage a little more actively the duration of the fund. It's AAA rated by Standard & Poor's. I've listed in here the investments that we're authorized to utilize in the pool. It's rated because we're a standby purchaser for some debt issues of different agencies in the state that price regularly. Some debt issues will reprice fairly frequently, and what needs to be written into those bonds to make them more palatable to investors is that there is someone with a AAA standing who will take them out. If the bonds roll and there's not enough appetite to buy the bonds, we'll step in and buy the bonds. We've never had to do that, but we stand ready to do that, and that allows those bonds to be issued at a higher credit rating, which results in a lower borrowing cost for the state. In addition to the treasury pool, it's about $27 billion right now. It's putting up about a 1.6% yield, pretty tight with prime funds. We are positioned for a rising rate environment, which obviously pretty much everybody knows we're in right now. It's not a big secret. So we're keeping duration fairly short there. In addition to the treasury pool, at the other end of the spectrum, we manage 14 endowment funds totaling about $4 billion. They're managed for long-term preservation of capital and growth. So they're invested across the entire spectrum of possible asset types, from stocks and bonds to equities to privates and so forth. It's a large diversified portfolio, and it's one in which you all participate. It's a $4 billion fund, so you get the benefit of the economies of scale of $4 billion of purchasing power. We're invested in managers, some of whom would have $1 million minimum is pretty much the smallest allocation you can make to a lot of these managers, up to $10 million. And so your fund is currently a little over $3 million, and so you own pieces of very large investment strategies that would otherwise take large amounts of capital to get invested in. So we manage the endowments. That's the longest term money. A few sessions ago, the state developed the State Water Implementation Fund for Texas, the SWIFT. It was funded with a $2 billion appropriation, a constitutional appropriation, and that money is managed for the Texas Water Development Board. They draw against it to subsidize the cost of bonds that they issue to fund local state water projects. And so it's a long-term drawdown fund. We know they're going to take out more than we can earn. So we know it's going to go down over time. It will ultimately bottom. So we manage it with a liquidity focus on one end, but we also have a growth objective as well. So it's kind of bifurcated. It's a lot shorter term duration than the endowment funds, but a lot longer than the treasury pool. So that's the SWIFT. And then we also manage the state's rainy day fund, the Economic Stabilization Fund. It's about a $10.5 billion fund. Traditionally has been held in the treasury pool. And a couple sessions ago, the legislature asked us to manage a component of it for a slightly higher return. So our objective there is to earn a little more than we can earn in treasury pool without subjecting it to much risk, and also to earn at least the rate of inflation, which is becoming more challenging every day. We've been able to meet both of those objectives with the, it's called the TSTIF, the Texas Economic Stabilization Investment Fund. The marketing people missed that meeting, and so it's a struggle with that stuff for technicians. And then the a couple of sessions ago, the state decided to do away with the Emerging Technology Fund. It was a fund that was run out of the governor's office of economic development, and it was, they made investments in early stage venture companies, biotechnology, medical devices, consumer products, software, et cetera. And so when they ended the program, they had about 130 stranded assets out there that they put about $160 million into with no home. And so they moved those assets to us. And so we manage the former Emerging Technology Fund with the objective of winding it down while maximizing its return. So one of the things you don't want to do with a fund like that is just sit back on your laurels and let it go, because what happens is the successful companies will raise additional rounds of financing, and if you don't participate, you effectively get crammed down in the capital structure. And then when a successful exit occurs, you're the first one in, you took the most risk, and you get the least out. So the legislature provided us with some follow-on capital, which we've used. We've gone through the whole 130 companies. We've got about, I think, 100, not all of whom have a heartbeat. And so we're in the process of winding down those that, you know, we'll call some of them and nobody answers the phone. And we just have to go through the process of legally folding them up. But we do have some that we think have great potential. So we're optimistic that we can produce some decent returns. But that's been a great experience for us as well. But that kind of gives you an idea of the range of types of investments that we manage, from early stage venture to money funds. So that's kind of what sets us up. And it's a, you know, it's in the Texpool and Texpool Prime, I don't want to forget to mention those, local government investment pools that we oversee. They are where states and where municipalities and school districts and libraries and MUDs and so forth park their operating dollars. So they're money funds as well. There's a prime one, there's a prime fund, and there's a government one. And they're also AAA rated. So we oversee those as well. They total about $27 billion. There's a pie chart on page 9 that lays all this out with the dollar amounts to give you just a snapshot. It's a little over $60 billion as of September 30. And then we have boards. We report to three boards. The Controller's Investment Advisory Board, that's listed on page 10, kind of oversees everything. We report to them quarterly. Texpool has its own board, half of whom are participants. We report to them quarterly. And then the largest endowment that we manage, the Tobacco Settlement Permanent Trust of Kent, has its own investment advisory board. It's about a $2.5 billion of the $4 billion. And we report to them a couple times a year. And then this is an organization chart on page 11, just to give you a snapshot of that. Any questions about the trust company?
How many total employees?
We've got, I believe it's 85 authorized FTEs at present. A lot of them are back office, accounting. We have trust services, client-facing employees. We have investment accounting. We have general ledger accounting. We've got an IT division, because we develop an interface for our agency clients. We also manage agency funds. I didn't mention that. It's $2 billion. I don't want to let that go. For different agencies that have to hold money outside of the Treasury, they may issue bonds, and oftentimes we'll hold those proceeds, invest them in GICs, and then we interface with those clients, and we have developed automated systems so that they can deal with us the same way they might with a bank, so that they can go online, they can direct movement of money and things like that. But we have client-facing people for them. We've got the wire room, settlements and custody. Quite a number of people are required to handle the state's unclaimed property. We get escheated securities, mutual funds, and so forth. And we hold the securities in our DTC account, have to account for those. And then we've got folks that manage the treasury pool. We have a trading desk. And then we have folks that manage the endowments and the SWIFT and the ETF and so forth.
We only count 60 just in.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is a current. I didn't tally them up. Somebody told me at budget time we have 85 authorized, and we're not full. I mean, we don't have them. We don't have all the positions filled. But anyway, a lot of moving parts. If you want to flip to tab 2, this is what we put together quarterly for the large $4 billion endowment fund that we run through with the with the Controller's Investment Advisory Board. And what we've done is we've scaled it down to the Texas Financial Education Endowment. That there's an executive summary I won't go through up front. You can read that at your leisure. And that's just an update of what happened during the quarter. And this is the third quarter. This is as of September 30. We don't have 12/31 audited numbers yet. So this is as recent as we've presented to the Controller and his advisory board. But this will just kind of give you a narrative of what happened in the total portfolio and then the various different asset classes, what was going on in any one of those. Page 7 is the asset allocation summary. So, you know, before we invest a fund, we do an asset allocation study to determine, you know, how do we want to position this portfolio to achieve our return objective with the least amount of risk. And the return objective here is inflation. Now it's inflation plus 4, which is going to be 6-7% probably on a nominal basis, you know, depending on what inflation does. And this is the mix. The long-term target on the right is what we consider to be the optimal mix to get to that return objective with the least amount of risk, which volatility is what we consider risk. You know, how smooth is the return pattern? How erratic is it? And then the weight shows where we are relative to the target. And the two categories that you'll see are the most underweight are private debt and then the private real estate, private equity. Well, that's because those take a long time to fund up. And we started putting this money to work. I think we got it in 2013. It's when this account was, April of 2013. And so it took us a little while to start putting the money to work. But in the privates, one of the things we were able to do was the legislature appropriated several permanent endowments, and then a few sessions ago when they were having to shake the seat cushions out, they were looking for operating dollars, they kind of reappropriated them back. So they lost their permanent status. And so the good news for you guys is we were, you know, as we're liquidating those funds to make them available for their new intended purpose, we just took slices of the private portfolio and we were able to buy them into your fund at net asset value. So it was kind of a win-win. The seller got net asset value for their privates. You got to buy them at net asset value. It's an incredibly diversified portfolio of private funds. I think there are a total of 33 different private funds. There are 47 different real asset funds, which is real estate funds, and 45 private equity funds that you're diversified. So you'd be in a private equity fund that has $1 million to $5 million to $10 million minimum, and you'll have $45,000 in it, which is great. It's a really, really nicely diversified portfolio. So this is the mix as it stands as of September 30th, the end of the third quarter. And then we always look at the variance versus target, and I think I discussed that briefly, like why we have the variance that we do for the most part. And then the sand chart on page 9 just shows you how the money has been put to work over time. And you can see that we slowly began building the real estate and private equity and private credit portfolios over time. And they're getting larger, so you can see how the shape of the portfolio has changed. And here we're showing assets of $2.986 million. That's September 30. I think you all made a deposit in November of about $700,000. Right. And so the current value is $3.771 million over contributions of $3,250,000. So you've got an investment gain in the portfolio of about $521,000. So funds
over the life of the line.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, you put in $3,250,000 and it's worth $3,771,000. So it's growing. We've had pretty friendly markets, as you all know, and it's starting to get a little bit choppy, which we're actually pleased about. I mean, it's nice when everything goes up, but it's a little bit Pollyanna-ish to believe that that's going to go on forever. When fundamentals don't matter, at some point fundamentals reassert themselves, and one company being better than another starts to be appreciated in the market. Hopefully that's starting to come to the fore. We've got a lot of active management here.
So, Paul, when we make contributions, do you try to keep it at this percentage, or that's kind of how it is stated?
Yes, ma'am. We do to the extent we can, and as each year we raise like a private equity pool, and so all the money that comes in that year we'll share in that pool, and then we'll cut it off. And next year we'll start another pool. So it's you receive your pro rata allocation to every new investment we make. You get a pro rata allocation of it.
Okay.
liquidity is reflected on page 10. Something we monitor carefully as well. You need liquidity to meet capital calls on private investments. So if you commit $10 million to a private equity fund, they're going to call capital, and you need to have cash ready to meet those capital calls as they need it, as they find things to buy, things to do. So we have a liquidity committee that's constantly monitoring liquidity and making sure we have plenty, and we do. This shows you the bands. Those two dark bands at the top show what our guidelines are. We're well in excess of what we need to meet our liquidity requirements. The portfolio's geographic allocation. We try to tactically tilt the portfolio to where we think stuff is cheaper. And we think European non-U.S. equities are trading a lot cheaper than U.S. equities are, and emerging markets equities are trading at about half the cost of developed market equities. We've got an emerging markets tilt in the portfolio. We think that's a good, and again, we think long-term. We're not thinking week to week. But we think value ultimately prevails, and we've got those are very dynamic economies right now as China tries to make the transition to a consumer-driven economy from an export economy. India has made a number of reforms that are favorable to investors. They've just put in place a bankruptcy law, which is favorable to creditors. It used to be if you got in the courts in India, your children might see the end of that case. They're facilitating that process and making it much friendlier to lenders. They've also put in a real estate law. There are some problems with real estate development in India, but Prime Minister Modi's put a lot of reforms in, tax reform, and so forth. So it's the environment in India is looking pretty interesting right now as well. So we like emerging markets, and you can see those tilts in this geographic allocation table. Fixed income summary. These are just, this looks like a song sheet. I apologize for all the numbers. But these are the metrics that we monitor. If you just want to, I won't walk through all the numbers, but the U.S. Universal is the basic core fixed income benchmark. And if you look at this, it's 1, 2, 3. The fourth line down is the U.S. Universal. And if you track your finger to the right, the first number you run into is standard deviation. That's how volatile is the return pattern of the U.S. Universal. And it's 2.7%. That's the level, which is pretty low volatility. But if you go to the bottom of the page, total fixed income, you can see the volatility of our overall portfolio is lower than that. The Sharpe ratio is a measure of how well you're paid for the risk you're taking. So you can see the Universal has a Sharpe ratio just over 1, and our portfolio has 1.4. So we would appear to be being paid better for any level of risk we're taking than that core fixed income portfolio. We look at downside deviation and maximum drawdown, number of positive months, and our portfolio puts up a positive return 72% of the time. The U.S. Universal does about 64% of the time. And then the objective is for this piece of the portfolio to have a low correlation with equities, because you want balance in the portfolio. When things go up, when things go down, you want other things that go up, right? And so you want things that don't move in concert. And that's the reason for stocks and bonds. And so we design these portfolios. We've got this alternative fixed income category that is it's designed to be uncorrelated with everything, with bonds and with stocks, but to put up returns that are competitive with bonds, which isn't particularly difficult right now given the low level of interest rates. But these are strategies that tend to be more complex and a little more, require a lot more work and a lot more monitoring. But they've been putting up very favorable returns and doing their job. We can see the correlations with the ACWI, which is the global equity index. The alternative fixed income book is low. The beta is a measure that's even a better measure of its how it tracks with an index, and the beta is like 0.2, so it's really pretty much nothing. So it's doing its job. A snapshot of the portfolio down below, you can see that we have ours is the dark bars there in the upper left-hand corner. That's our portfolio. You can see we have a heavier allocation to credit than does the universal. We've thought credits have been, which is basically corporate bonds, get a higher yield, which is noted in the upper right-hand corner, and we manage the portfolio with a much shorter duration than the universal, given our view that interest rates are rising, and longer duration gets punished in a rising rate environment. So we're kind of prepared for that. And then we show the growth of a dollar in the lower left-hand corner. That now, I will tell you, it looks like we're underperforming the U.S. universal. We changed our benchmark in the end of 2016. And rather than show how the portfolio was actually outperforming its previous benchmark, and so we revisited it and thought, well, gee, should we, what's called the Multiverse, which is a global fixed income index, and that was driven a lot by currency valuations, and so we decided we'd take that out and substitute the universal. But we, rather than give ourselves credit from 2013 through 2016 for outperforming the benchmark, we, you know, decide we, anytime we can beat ourselves up, we want to do that. So we put the new index in, and so it shows underperformance. But from the point of changeover, you can see the portfolio, just the slope of the line, the black one versus the red one, is very similar. So it's been performing in line, if not outperforming, actually, the universal since we changed indices. If you want to flip to private debt, again, this is just a snapshot of the private debt portfolio. You can see we have the first column there. We've got performing and distressed. We're trying to position now. We're late in the cycle, we think, the economic cycle. We think distressed experts will be helpful to us as the leverage starts to work its way up in the system. We're seeing loan covenants very light now, which is kind of a canary in the coal mine. When money gets easier and easier and easier, then typically credits get a little sketchier and sketchier, and then ultimately there's a price to pay. And you know, we hire experts in who can step into those stressed situations and work them out. And typically you can do that more profitably. There's risk involved and very specialized expertise. And that's those are the folks we have in the distressed column. And distressed has recently been outperforming performing private credit. Performing private credit would be direct lending funds, which have grown in popularity, and so we've stopped really doing much of that because it's, again, they're getting too easy, the returns are too low, and so we've kind of backed away from allocating to performing credit managers. But the portfolio put up about a 12% return last year, and since inception it's put up about a 7, which gets us to our investment objective. Equity is on the next page. We have long-only equity, which are global equity managers. And we have hedged equity, which are long and short managers. And hedged equity is you get a lot of the equity upside, but you get a lot less of the downside because they have short positions. They can profit when the market's going down. So we actually have a larger allocation to hedged equity than long equity. It's part of our risk control focus. Again, we want to get paid for the risk we're taking, and ultimately we want all the upside and none of the downside, but in an imperfect world, you have to suffer some of the downside, and you don't get all the upside, but that's what we're looking for. And then the pie charts on the bottom just show how the various portfolios are diversified. You can see they're pretty darn well diversified. And then more on the public equity portfolio, the growth of the dollar versus benchmarks, how our portfolio is positioned relative to the ACWI, the global world the global equity index. And then on the right-hand side, this is the long-short, the hedged equity portfolio. The orange bar in the middle shows their net exposure. They'll have long positions and short positions, and if you net the two out, you get the net position, which shows how much exposure you have to the equity market. And you can see it's muted. It's about 68% as of September 30th, and we just kind of watch how it's moving. And our managers took exposure up, which actually has helped them, but it's something that we pay attention to. Private equity on page 17, you can see you have both buyout and venture. You have 37 buyout funds and 8 venture funds. And you can see the dollar amount of commitments, how much of that commitment is yet to be funded, how much we have funded, how much has been distributed, and what the remaining value is. So if you take the remaining value plus the distributions, you get the total value. So we have put $289 million to work, and the value of both what we've received and what's left is $337 million. So the portfolio, the total value to paid in capital, at if you look at the bottom set of columns, it's the second number in, is 1.16 overall. So for every dollar we've put in, we have $1.16 in value that we've earned. The portfolio put up an internal rate of return of 15% last year, and since inception, it's 9%. So the private equity portfolio is doing what we hope it would do. Real assets, this is again a diversifier. It's going to be real estate and natural resources, which is effectively commodities. And they're both in there just as diversifying asset classes that don't move in concert with equities. and so much with bonds. And we've got the detail on that on page 19. This is the real estate portfolio. We have stable value that's often referred to as core real estate. That would be like a downtown office building that's 95 or 96% leased, and you don't have any lease roll risk, so the leases are longer term. It's like owning a bond, effectively. So you might get some capital appreciation reflective of inflation as the rents rise with inflation. So it's a very stable, solid real estate investment. An enhanced return tend to be properties that have some kind of more risk in them. They have development risk, they have lease-up risk, those types of risks. So you hire experts at executing on those strategies, and you expect to earn a higher return because you're taking more risk with those. And there are 28 enhanced return managers in the portfolio and 17 stable value. Real estate's just been incredibly, I mean, surprised me how well real estate has been performing, but it's been playing. And the real estate portfolio put up an 11.4% return last year, or the year ending September 30th, and it's since inception 11%. So it's done incredibly well. And then the portfolio diversification of both the stable value enhanced is reflected in the pie chart at the bottom of page 19. And then page 20 just is reflective of how this is a commodities portfolio, and so it's very volatile, as are commodity prices. But this is one of those long-term investments you make as a hedge against inflation. And everybody in this room feels the volatility of commodities, especially in terms of oil, because I know there's some bankers in the room. And you probably have some exposure or may have some exposure to the oil field, and that the price of the commodity is directly related to the operating businesses in some cases. But anyway, so this is a very volatile piece of the portfolio, but it's there for long term for inflation protection. And most of this exposure is now through futures. So you construct a portfolio of futures contracts that are reflective of the general broad commodities market. And the all asset strategies, this is one investment actually in what's called a multi-strategy hedge fund. And so they can move across the spectrum of possible investments. And so really this is as much, they've done a good job. They've put up some good numbers. Last year they put up a better number than we did. So they've been additive. But we really look to all the investments that we make as partnerships where we extract information from all of our managers. What are they seeing in the market? Where are they finding opportunities? How are they positioning? And then we're able to bring that thinking into how we look at our portfolio and position it. And this fund does a particularly good job of moving around from credit to what's called merger arbitrage to equities. And so we just gather information from those guys and we incorporate it into our thinking as we're positioning our portfolio. And it pays, so it's also putting up good numbers. Then we're very risk sensitive, so we have a risk group within our organization. And we have actually some guardrails, value at risk, that we have to manage inside of. So we know we can't take too much risk. And the gauge on the upper right hand, in the upper right hand corner, is that gauge. You can see the red zones, the minimum and maximum amount of risk that we're allowed to take. And it turns out September 30th that we just happen to be right on policy in terms of the amount of volatility that's in the portfolio. And the lower right hand bar chart kind of shows you where that comes from. And as you would expect, the long red bar is equity. And that's the most volatile thing in the portfolio. And given its weight in the portfolio, you can see what kind of an impact it has on overall portfolio volatility. So we try to diversify away from that to keep risk at levels that we think are appropriate. And then the portfolio risk summary, we crash test the portfolio. So we load the portfolio into a system and we say, what if 1987 Black Monday happened? It was a 5-day event. What would happen to our portfolio? And the red bar, the dark red bar, is if you had a standard 65% S&P 500, 35% bond index fund, how would it react? And then the orange is how would our investment policy react? And you can see that we would have less of a drawdown in any of these scenarios than a traditional portfolio, and that's our objective. What we have found, that's what this is about. And the little green box is how our actual portfolio would react, and it would react a little less well than the modeled portfolio, and that's simply because we have short duration. In times of crisis, long duration, long-term bonds tend to do the best, and so we're not in a lot of long-term bonds, but we're good with that. And then performance on page 24, this is rolling performance over 1, 2, 3, and 4 year periods for the total portfolio. Last year, well, September, as of September 30, it put up a 10.9% return. We don't have audited numbers for October, November, December. We have unaudited numbers, and so I can tell you it's probably going to be closer to a little over 11% for the calendar year, the rolling return. And again, it takes time to put money to work, so the longer term numbers will catch up. And then we've got a month by month on page 25. And what we track is, you know, I'm very sensitive to how we're doing relative to a simple portfolio of stocks and bonds, long stocks and bonds. And so we look at risk and return, and we have a scatter diagram. We don't have 5 years data yet on this fund, but over 5 years, what we found is we're getting about 95% of the return we would get in a simple portfolio of stocks and bonds, right? But we're getting it with half the risk. And so that's, you know, my objective is I want more for less. We want more for less, more return for less risk. So we're constantly working on trying to solve that equation. And I'm, you know, very pleased with the results. If we can get 90, 92 or 95% of the return for half the risk, that's a good day for us. So we're real pleased with the way that seems to be working. Anyway, so I'll stop. I talk fast and I talk a lot, so I apologize if I talk too much, but any questions? Yes, sir.
First of all, let me explain that the last thing I understood is the number of employees you had.
Sorry.
So
trying to go
didn't
fast.
Really, you asked him why it didn't match.
Yeah, sure. So the funds that this organization has in here, it's just mixed in with everybody else's fund.
Yes, sir.
We are a percentage of these investments, correct?
That's correct.
Could you just, let's take one, private debt detail, or private debt.
Huh?
Explain that to me in layman's terms.
Okay. Now, a public debt manager, you could buy high-yield bonds, you could buy treasury bonds, you could buy high-grade corporate bonds, you could buy commercial paper. Those are all liquid. You can trade them in the market. A private credit manager, some of them, we're looking for managers that are kind of specialized, hopefully niche managers, who are able to put up returns that are higher than you could get in the public markets, right? And so, for instance, we have a manager that that is very focused on a particular segment of the healthcare industry, and they know how to loan to a drug discovery company who has developed a product and they've licensed it to, let's say, Merck to market for them. Merck pays them a royalty for that right. These guys understand enough about the market to be able to discount the value of that royalty and lend against it. So it's very niche-y. You have to understand that market very well in order to underwrite it properly. But as a guy, I heard a guy once say, there's no such thing as a bad bond, just a bad price. So if you know how to underwrite a circumstance, and we look again for niche managers that have tight expertise around a certain area. We have a lot of that in some distressed debt managers that understand the bankruptcy process, in merger arbitrage, where they understand the regulatory process. If a merger is announced, typically the price between the acquired company, they'll say, we're going to buy this company for $100. And it's currently trading at 70. So the price typically will move to like 98. It doesn't quite move to 100, or maybe it'll move to 88. And the difference, the reason it doesn't move to 100 is because the risks in completing that merger are regulatory, maybe, and financing. Are they going to be able to get the finance, the acquiring company, to buy the acquired company on the terms that they expect to get that will make this thing work? And are the regulators going to step in? You know, everybody's seen the Time Warner merger that got put on hold, right? That was totally unexpected. Everybody got that one wrong. But that's kind of an exception. And that was a regulatory risk nobody was looking for. But private credit managers, and we have some direct lending managers, one of our themes has been because of Dodd-Frank and regulations that have been imposed on banks, there are certain things they can't do that they would like to do that aren't particularly risky, but because of the way the regulations are written, they can't do. So we're able to find managers who can do those things and can step in and make those loans to provide capital where it's needed, and it's not particularly risky. It's just there's this regulatory dislocation at the moment that we're able to step in and take advantage of.
So then my next question would be, again, maybe a naive question, but is there any emphasis or focus on trying to invest in Texas funds?
Well, all things being equal, if we find a manager who's located, we have a venture capital manager that's located here in Austin, as a matter of fact, that we've committed capital to. They're on their second fund. We're typically not going to be the first money into a manager. Now, with the Emerging Technology Fund, that's a different animal. They're all Texas. But those were investments that were not made by us. We've inherited them. All things being equal, we would favor a Texas manager. But, you know, we look for fairly niche strategies.
I'm sorry, what's niche?
Well, like, you know, not common strategies.
I suppose the Chinese food.
Specialized. That's delicious, by the way. Specialized strategies that there aren't a lot of players in. You try to find people who maybe rolled out of larger organizations and have specialized expertise in an area that's not overwhelmed with capital. That's the problem right now. There's so much capital looking for returns that a lot of the returns get washed out. When an abundance of capital shows up, you know, it gets overwhelmed, underwriting standards go down, and the returns do with it. So we're looking for those areas that have yet to be overwhelmed with capital.
Can I ask a question? I think Vince was, yeah. Maybe this will help on the number of employees. Do you know what percent y'all's cost is in managing?
Yeah, we charge 30 basis points.
Okay.
0.3% of the endowments. We charge, I think, 0.2 for the SWIFT, less for the T-STIF, and less for the Treasury pool. And it just depends on the complexity of the strategy.
And that's a complete net, that's all fees?
That's all fees. Everything is 30 basis points, and we will rebate, which we have traditionally. We rebate anything we don't use. Okay. So the costs have been closer to 26 or less in the past.
I had a different question.
Yes, ma'am.
More pertaining, I guess, to page 9 is probably the easiest page to look at.
Sure.
So in that case, didn't have more November monies, which I understand. So now we're at about 3.25 and we're at 3.7 in value.
Correct.
So I guess my question would be, given our next agenda item is to add potentially additional funds into the fund, another 750 deposit, if that were to be the case, would you expect a great difference in our allocations or our strategy based on that additional deposit?
No, ma'am. We just, again, pro rata distribute it, and you continue to participate, but at a larger level in all new investments that are made. We try to keep it, but we would keep it in balance.
Okay, and would you expect that would impact our return in any way?
Well, the more we can get into private equity, right, private real estate, private credit, I think the higher the returns will be. So there's a little difference in the return on this portfolio versus the broader portfolio, and it's because we started building those privates in 2005.
Right.
Again, we allocate year after year after year, kind of even amounts in order to get to our target. We're having a hard time staying, getting the 10% and staying there in private equity because everybody's selling stuff. Prices are high, so our private equity managers are selling their investments and returning capital to us faster than we can put it out, which, yeah, it's good news, bad news. You know, bad news is we can't get that exposure up. The good news is we're making good money on those investments.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I just have a comment, and I just wanted to say thanks to Mr. Ballard and the work of the Treasury Safekeeping Trust Company. We feel very fortunate that the Financial Education Endowment is a part of your portfolio of endowments, and just appreciate the work of you and your staff and enabling us to be a part of that program.
We know we're a very small fish in a very big pond, and we appreciate it.
We take care of all the fish. We're real proud of the work we do. We think this is kind of unique, and it's a lot of fun being able to deliver this kind of, you know, it's a kind of a unique bird, I think, among states. I'm not sure how many. They all have pension funds, and some of them have endowment funds. But anyway, this is something that's a lot of fun. We like doing it. Very proud of it, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate it. Okay, with that, can we have the report on activities relating to TP?
There's a written report on page 27. I don't have anything else to add other than the written report today.
Okie doke. And next we have a discussion of impossible vote to recommend that the Finance Commission take action on the proposal for the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending to contribute $750,000 to the TFE. And I want to mention that this kind of ties into page 19 of the packet, where it shows that the excess funds that the Savings and Mortgage Lending have is about 12.5 months, and this if you then look to your page 29, gives what the pro forma would be should we approve the 750 contribution.
Caroline, do you have anything to add you'd like to add to that?
Yes, I just wanted to, as y'all will recall, last fiscal year we made an initial contribution to TIFI, SML did, and we had talked then about potential additional contributions if able to. And the main goal was to, it does impact, as you can see, the reserves, but the main goal was for Savings and Mortgage Lending to participate in its oversight board's endowment and to contribute in for finances in this way if appropriate and if we could. And at this point in time, we do believe that we can contribute $750,000, and that would be our recommendation is for approval to do so.
And something that I think you brought up, Vince, is they don't budget for when there's
penalties.
And so at the end of the year, we'll revisit it again.
Correct.
To see, you know, if additional penalties are collected. Once again, we'll probably revisit doing another contribution depending upon what the cash flow.
Correct.
So what would happen if we didn't do this? That money would stay in the organization?
Yeah.
Correct.
And if there's a liquidity policy that's coming up for approval in the regular meeting, and basically it says, like, you want to be in the six-month and below when it comes to excess funds, and why not get those funds to work for us if you're over the 6 months,
are we concerned all about unexpected expenses such as elevators and stuff, the need maintenance, and or the cost of a future building?
And we have taken all of that into account. And so yes, we would not want to contribute an amount that would leave us without the both operational funds we need and the future issues that we may have to pay for. So we've taken that into consideration.
Okay.
At this point, yes.
What is the direction of the commission in terms of the legislature in focusing on this particular category?
Well, financial literacy is one of our missions.
Right.
So
is there a specific, I understand that very, very clearly. My question is, how is there any specific direction in terms of what can be generated to support this?
Yes, there's statutory authority for the Finance Commission to accept contributions or to solicit contributions and from state agencies. And so part of the initial thought was, since we are a state agency,
right,
under your oversight, that would be a logical partnership, or not partnership, but logical contribution.
No, sir.
And we did, before we discussed the original contribution, we did work with the Attorney General's office to make sure that our statutory authority, the statutory authority, is there.
Any other questions on it? If not, do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings Mortgage Lending to contribute $750,000 to the Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Okay, there being no further business, this meeting of the Audit Committee of the Finance Commission of Texas is now adjourned. The time is 9:03.